Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host of Blog Talk Radio, Setting Light. We have back with us today our guest, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and author of the newly released book, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison. But before we start the show, I'd like to let everyone know that Mariam is on with us today, but she may have to leave early. Not sure, but because she herself has a mother who right now is very ill. And I will let Mariam explain this to you because it relates so much to the people in prison who have loved ones on the outside, especially parents or children who are in severe need right now, and they cannot be there. So I'm going to introduce Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist. Mariam, are you on with us?
Yes, Leona, I am on with you, and thank you for inviting me to the show again.
Thank you so much for coming on. I know that right now your time is limited with your mother's situation. Can you please explain to the audience a little bit about what's been going on with your mom and some of the issues that you've had to deal with as a result?
Yes, my mom, she is very old. She's 95 years old, and she lived in a nursery home. It was very difficult for her to walk. She has arthrosis. I don't know if that's an English word. She fell a couple of weeks ago, and now she is in a kind of a hospital. And we know now that she cannot walk anymore. She will never be able to walk anymore. And she's really at the end of her life. So she can pass away any day now. I visit her a couple of times a day, and also my brother. I have one brother, and my sister-in-law, my children. We all visit her the whole day through. In fact, what I see is that because my mom also suffers from a form of dementia. I don't know if it's Alzheimer, but it's a form of dementia. And for her, it means that the environment where she is now is completely strange to her. She doesn't see the logic of the environment. the staff are very friendly, but they also are strange faces. So what we see is that when we visit her and she sees us, her own children, her own grandchildren, she can recognize us, and we see that looking, you know, us in the face gives her a little bit of comfort and especially safety in this unsafe world she's in now. And I explain this situation because, well, for the show we always talk about, of course, the incarcerated individuals. But I am also aware of the fact that there are also elderly people in prison with a life sentence who can get in the same situation as my mom, where they might get dementia or Alzheimer or something else, and that they feel so vulnerable in this harsh environment of the prison system. They don't have the luxury that my mom has of, you know, having the children close by, feeling the comfort of the familiarity of your own family. And now seeing my mom, it makes me realize how important that is. But unfortunately, in prison, it's not present, you know, and that's very, very sad. And it's, in fact, to me, it's another form of dehumanization of individuals, human beings who are incarcerated.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, Mariam, because there are so many prisoners who have said in the past years that when they have lost their loved ones, mainly their parents or their children or their spouse, that they can only go alone. They're brought to the funeral parlor alone in the evening to view the body, but they're not allowed to be with the family members when these situations happen. I know that it's difficult for you with your mom, especially at her age and being so close to her as you always seem to have been, and to have to go through this, it must be very painful.
Yeah, it is, but it's also painful when I translate my situation to incarcerated people, because I do have the luxury to visit my mom and to give her discomfort. And when you think about incarcerated elderly people who are not able to meet their family members, this has nothing to do with safety, because elderly people are no danger for anyone. So keeping them incarcerated and keeping family away from them serves only the purpose of dehumanization, because there is no other reason, no other purpose to do this. They are not dangerous at all anymore. So this makes very clear that the system is a dehumanizing system.
You know, it's so sad that the way prisoners are treated, it's, you know, a recent incident happened where a prison guard got stabbed. And there was a legislative member that, you know, that said it was truly sad, and then made some kind of comment about visiting the prison because of that prison guard. And it reminded me of something that I state all the time to the audience: prisoners should not be stereotyped. The way the comment came out made me feel as though now that this prison guard was stabbed, that all prisoners, you know, at that particular prison or elsewhere, all prisoners are the cause of these things. They fail to realize that individuals incarcerated are so different, and they also have gotten stabbed. They also have gotten shot to death out in the streets, and they also have gone through the same thing many of the law enforcement and correctional officers and prison officials have gone through. Again, a lot of times when these people are provoking and causing so much pain to the incarcerated individuals, they eventually, these individuals get so frustrated that they lash out. And that's why, as of tomorrow, we will be starting the whole month of June to make these calls, write these letters, and send these emails to legislative members, to the media, to governors, to the ACLU, to get these messages out. These people, they are so suppressed, so oppressed, that they have no way out, and they lash out any way they can. And unfortunately, a guard here and there is going to get hurt, just as is law enforcement out on the street. And I know they have families as well, but their families will be allowed to go to the funerals if they do, you know, die. Their families will be able to go, but the incarcerated, those who are being oppressed and those who are being tormented and tortured and have nowhere to let their frustration out except on one another or on those overseers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there is a very big mistake that's made all the time, and that is that aggression is the problem in the prison. But as you say, the problem is not aggression. The problem is suppression. And aggression is the result of this suppression. If I get suppressed 24 hours a day, one day I will flip. One day I will, you know, get aggressive. That's a natural reaction. Nobody can live under oppression for 24 hours a day, year in, year out, without becoming aggressive at some point. But the aggression is not a problem. It's a result of the way the system functions. Whether it's a guard that gets stabbed or a prisoner, everybody, both staff and incarcerated individuals, they both are in this environment, this hostile environment. I felt it when I was in Florida. I felt this oppression myself, and it shocked me. So, and I was there only for a few afternoons. So if you live there and you work there, that's asking for this problem or this result of aggression. But the thing is, when aggression is visible, you know, it's visible. So they see aggression as the problem, and then they oppress more. So you get this negative cycle of aggression and oppression and more aggression, more oppression, etc. And it's all, you know, in the name of safety, of security. But there are a lot of rules in the system that have nothing to do with safety. I'm going to visit the prison, as you know, Leona, in September. And I looked at the protocol of, you know, the, how do you say that, what I can wear, my clothes. I cannot wear a blue jeans, but I can wear another blue trousers. That's a senseless rule. It has no meaning. It's teasing people. It's bullying people. It's making it more and more difficult to stay connected to your loved ones inside prison.
It's sad that these things happen because a lot of people travel long distances to see their loved ones. I remember a time when a woman, single, well, her husband was incarcerated, came all the way from New York to Massachusetts with her two children. And they came to see their loved one, and they couldn't get in because of some minor issue with the way that someone was dressed. And that woman was crying because that's the long distance when you're with children and you're by yourself as a female traveling. And it was sad because she was turned away, not knowing anyone here. I felt really bad about it. And if I, as an individual, can feel that kind of compassion or feel that kind of pain that she was going through, you would think that people overseeing the prisons that are supposed to be so righteous in rehabilitating and reforming these individuals that have made mistakes, you would think they'd have some kind of compassion for a female with two children that has done nothing wrong but travel to see her loved one. But this is the mentality that we have of the people overseeing the incarcerated individuals. There's no hope. There's no compassion with them. There's no fairness. I can't imagine anybody, and even though they're working in the penal system where there are many really bad individuals, they also know there's many, many thousands of people that are in there that are good, that have made mistakes or are in for wrongful convictions.
Yeah, and I think, Leona, when you say there are bad people, but isn't that our obligation to restore these bad people? You know, I think everyone, despite what that person is in for or whatever he has done, I mean, we don't need to forget it. I mean, when I commit a crime, then I am responsible for what I did. And we don't need to take away that responsibility. But treating people with dignity should be done with everyone equally, without making distinction between the bad people or the good people or whatever. Everybody deserves an approach of dignity. And what you see now also in your example of that family who wanted to visit their loved one, then you see that dehumanization in the prison system is extended to the families. So it goes also beyond the prison wall. And that's very sad. I think, you know, when you say that in June, it's the month of, you know, calling the prisons, calling the senators, the politicians and all that. I think maybe because sometimes people call in the show and they say, what can I do? What can we do? How can we change it? I think what is very important is to keep mentioning that in prison are incarcerated human beings. They are human beings like we all are, and emphasizing that there are no inmates. There are incarcerated human beings. And I think when people realize that more and more, that could lead to a change to rehabilitation. Because what you see now is that incarcerated individuals are called inmates. The word inmate is a label, and it refers to an object. And when a human being is objectified, then there is this danger that you can do whatever you want to do with that, you know, with that inmate, because he or she is not a human being. I wrote about that subject in my book because I saw the comparison with the concentration camps in World War II, where the Jewish people were no longer considered human. And so they could do whatever they wanted to do, because in their minds, they didn't have anything to do with human beings. They only had to do with, in German it's called the Untermensch. So it's below human values. And that's what you also see in prison. And that, I think that makes it easier when you objectify somebody, give them the label inmate, than torturing that person or do whatever you want to do with him. You don't feel it, because to you it's not a human being anymore. And that's, I think in that it's very important, when you are supporting change, reminding politicians, key figures, and keep reminding them of, we are talking about human beings, we are not talking about objects. I think it's very important to repeat this message with everything that you want to say, that you want to do, because that mindset really has to change. That's my opinion.
And it's true. It's true. I don't know how they do it in your countries over there, but I do know that in this country it's so different. People are so different. People want to stay in division, it seems, and they don't want to look at these factors that you present. And this is what's so important. If we are going to be advocates, if we are going to help our loved ones who are incarcerated, we need to work in unity, and we need to work on these issues, very issues that you discuss. Other countries can do it. I can't understand why they can in this country, unless it's, as you mentioned before, these large corporations that are benefiting off of mass incarceration. And this is something that needs to be addressed mainly before anything, is this mass incarceration. Is the money that's being made by big corporations and by the Department of Corrections by keeping the prisons packed?
Yeah, and I think these corporations can do that because they don't see the incarcerated individuals. They don't see them as human beings. They see them simply as bodies. And that mindset, it will take quite some time, I think, to change that mindset. But by reminding it over and over and over again, this pattern in thinking can be changed. Because if they get aware of the fact that there are people in there, that changes a lot. But it's a long way, but it's, of course, worth all the effort, because we have to release incarcerated individuals of their label inmate. I hate the word inmate. Sometimes I use it, but I hate it, because it's really like a stigma. It's a stigma.
I think we all do at times, because it's so mentioned so many times all the time. But I was told one time by prisoners in the previous years, how it came to be inmates, and it was not good. Just like you mentioned, we need to address these people as human beings, not as inmates, not as prisoners. And I do it myself because it's so mentioned so many times. But
yeah,
this is something that we have to work on.
Yeah, exactly, and that's a long way, because it means becoming aware of using certain language also influences behavior. So if we would talk about inmates all the time, you don't do that, I don't do that, but if we would do that, talk about inmates all the time, somewhere in the mind, you get away from this, the incarcerated individual as a human being. And it goes slowly, but these processes, they are very important to change the mindset. And every behavior on the outside starts with a change of mindset on the inside. It's a long way, but it can be done. It can be done. And it's especially important to remind, to keep key figures, what I said, politicians and all that, reminding we are talking about human beings. We are not talking about objects or bodies. We are talking about people. A part of the people is incarcerated and living in dreadful circumstances.
I want to ask you a question about your book, not to give all your information out, but I want to find out a bit about concentration camps. As you mentioned in the title, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, I know that it has something to do with the U.S. prisons, but what are the concentration camps? I know a lot of people understand what went on in concentration camps, but exactly what are some of the issues in these concentration camps that can be relayed?
Well, what I describe in my book, for instance, is the role reversal that you see. In the concentration camps, Jewish people had a very harsh time, of course, to survive if they were not gassed. And what you saw was that some Jews got privileges, but to get these privileges, they had to be harsh on their own fellow Jewish Jews. They did that to survive. What you also so you see a role reversal. The Jew who was a victim became an offender, in fact. That's exactly what you also see in the United States prison system, because when you look at what sometimes what guards do to prisoners, they are committing crimes in the prison system, which are punished when they are committed in the streets. So what you see is that offenders in the system become victims of the system, and the guards in the system become the offenders in the system. So
exactly.
You see this, and that's what you also saw on the in the concentration camps. And another thing which is very striking for me, what you saw in the concentration camps, and there are survivors who explain this, in these camps, they had all kinds of stupid rules who did not benefit anything. They had only one goal, and that was to torture. So they seemed logic rules, and you had to keep up with these rules, but they were senseless. They were meaningless. They were nonsense, and they could change every day. So for Jewish people, it was very difficult. You could, as a Jewish person, you could not say, oh, I follow the rules and then I will be safe. Because a lot of rules were almost impossible to follow. And secondly, they changed every day. So staying alive or being murdered was, in fact, a fact of coincidence. You could not save yourself by doing this or doing that, making yourself invisible or whatever. No, it was just good luck or bad luck, whether you would survive or not. And some of this randomness I see back in the United States prison system. You know, when I quote my loved one from prison, and you know, I told you about it, Leona, and he explained to me that if he has a complaint, for instance, a complaint about his prison, then he has to go through endless procedures. So at the end, it seems that incarcerated people have rights, because on paper they do have rights, but these rights are so difficult to reach, and that's what I call a form of suspending rights, and that's exactly what you also saw in the concentration camps. So these underlying elements of these systems, they really have similarities, and that shocks me, because when you look at these things as things like this, then I cannot say that Auschwitz is over, because in a way the structure still exists, and that's very shocking.
Mm-hmm. It is. I just, when I think about these other countries, your countries and others, who have shorter sentencing, more appropriate rehabilitation programs, you know, more humane discussions with the incarcerated that they deal with. Everything that is so good at that end is just so bad at this end. And again, you mentioned in the past too, which is so true, about the power and the greed, about the racism, about a lot of these issues that we're dealing with in the United States. I wonder sometimes, this is the United States, representatives of individuals and families from all over the world. You know, it's something we should be proud of, but on the other hand, it's something that this country takes for granted. And sometimes it's when you lose everything that you realize what you lost.
Yes, sometimes you have to go that far. Yeah.
Exactly. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, then I also come back to what I now see with my mom, and then I think about the elderly prisoners, what they have lost, and it was not necessary.
Yeah.
I think when you, that part of you that you speak about the prison system in the Netherlands, one of the biggest differences is that in the Netherlands, incarcerated people are people. I've never heard about a guard who tortures an incarcerated individual, or that prisoners have to be afraid, fear for their lives. They have access to healthcare, but the healthcare in the Netherlands is not completely privatized. So it's for everybody, it's, you know, better reachable. We all have an assurance, whether you have a job or not a job, it's mandate. So people in prison also have access, good access to healthcare. And I think that what you see is that we have another mindset. So then I come back to, we see incarcerated individuals as human beings. We can be shocked by what they have done. We also have people in prison who really have committed severe crimes, and I would be afraid of them if I would meet them in the streets. Of course, we are no saints, but still, whatever they have done, they are human beings. They are not another species, and that changes a lot in the system, because you don't torture a human being, but you can torture an individual when you don't consider that person as a human being. So that's a huge difference between the United States and the Netherlands. And incarceration in the Netherlands is not a million-dollar industry. We pay taxes for instance, for forensic psychiatry. And we accept that. It's not that there are corporal powers who benefit from forensic psychiatry or the prison system, which also makes it that our prisons don't need to stay full in order to make money. So our sentences can be shorter because, you know, in your country, long sentences mean full prisons mean making money. And because we don't have this million-dollar industry, we want to keep the sentences shorter because it's saving us tax money, for instance. But we only keep them shorter because the longer an incarcerated individual is away from domestic life, the more difficult it gets to rehabilitate and get back into society. So the damage is less when you have shorter sentences. That's one of the reasons that we have not these long sentences like in the United States.
Boils down to exactly what you say at all times, is these are human beings.
And I keep saying that because that's why I hope when when supporters, when reformers are going to be active in the month of June, I hope that this subject that we have to humanize again, you know, make the opposite movement towards the incarcerated people, make them human again, in fact, I hope that that will get a lot of attention, because that's really needed. That's the basis of a lot of solutions that can be made.
You know, I try to reiterate the fact that when everyone makes these calls and writes these letters and sends these emails, it doesn't have to be about every subject that we have listed. You know, ending the death penalty, ending life sentences, you know, defunding the Department of Corrections, replacing the contracted medical providers and psychological providers with independent providers, also bringing in, you know, oversight of the penal system, oversight of the prison officials, oversight of the Department of Corrections to defund until we see some positive interaction between the overseers and the incarcerated. If this can be done in other countries, it should be done in this country. To be looking at these people as human beings. So when I saw all the calls and emails and letter writing that everybody will be doing, talk about whatever the issues are that you see that are unjust. I see all of them as being unjust, but these are some others. Also housing incarcerated individuals accordingly, the elderly in elderly units, the middle-aged in separate units or blocks, the gang members in separate prisons or blocks, the youth that are in there that are not gang members in separate situations. Because when they put them all together, they're asking for a disaster. And this is what's been happening around the country, because they put all of these people together. First-time offenders should be separately. Victims who became offenders, wrongfully convicted, they should all be housed in different categories, in different prisons or blocks.
Yeah, I think what you see now in the prison is, you know, the United States was always famously known as the melting pot of cultures. But what you see in the prison is a melting pot of all kinds of people all put together, because there should be much more separation. I think also think about people who have to detox from an addiction. That's also a separate group. People who have psychiatric problems or trauma should be a complete different group. They cannot be all put together. That's part, I think, of what you see, what's happening in the system. They, you know, what we talked about in the 70s, you know, and I believe until the 60s or 70s, you had these hospitals as well, and they closed so many of the psychiatric hospitals and sent people out of the street in the streets, and they ended up in prison. And that's, well, it's it's logic that is devastating to people who have who suffer from trauma or psychiatric problems. And you also need a different kind of staff, because working with people who have really psychiatric problems, that's a complete different thing than keeping people safe as being a guard. Or if people need to get rid of their addictions, you need specially trained people to help them with that. That's again another way, another kind of staff that you should need. When you look at elderly people, true elderly people, people who are in their 80s or something, they need nurses and male nurses who are specialized in working with elderly people, because that's completely different from young people. So, you know, but now it's all together in one big, huge building, and the staff is not trained, and there is not enough specialized staff. Here in the Netherlands, we have a staff that is trained in, I only know the Dutch name, who are more like social workers, and we have guards who are there to maintain safety. But those are two different positions.
You know, when I think about it, long-term residential treatment facilities could have exactly what you just said, guards there for security. But long-term residential treatment facilities can be as long as prison sentencing, maybe less than life or death, but it can be as long as it takes. They will be getting the appropriate treatment, and there will be guards, as you say, there for safety reasons. Now, when I think about the prisons, the foundation of the prisons, I feel as though it can be so much more humane if they were long-term residential treatment facilities, either long-term residential anger management, long-term residential substance abuse, long-term residential mental health, but whatever the case may be, it's not going to be that hardcore prison environment. And this
exactly.
is where I think it would be so much more beneficial to not only the incarcerated, but also to their loved ones, to see them progress in a more positive way rather than degress. And I wanted to also mention suicides. This country has a high rate of suicides within the prisons. I often wonder if anyone ever tries to connect the causes of those suicides. You know, are they being violated to the point where they can't deal? I was reading somewhere in one of the emails that came to me about a trans who was sexually assaulted 2,000 times while incarcerated. And I could not believe that this can go on without any oversight, without any, I know PREA goes in when these things happen, and maybe that's how it was determined that this person had gone through all that. But there needs to be oversight, and there's
yeah.
no oversight whatsoever.
Exactly. I think oversight is so much needed, especially now that you what you see in the country, and you also see it worldwide, that conservative view on politics is getting stronger. What you see in society is step by step, but very small steps, private rights are taken away. And you see it's all politicized, like abortion, like the book banning in Florida, LGBTQ, I never know how to spell it.
LGBT.
Yeah, it's dehumanized, and, you know, it's connected to, oh, the kids are in danger, so the people believe that. They don't search for themselves what it all means. And it doesn't matter what one thinks of these subjects. You can agree, you can disagree, it doesn't matter. But I think we have to agree to the fact that whether we agree with it or not, it is a private right. And so it does not belong in politics, like abortion belongs in a doctor's office and should be discussed with a doctor or a psychologist, but not in politics. But you see this tendency of step by step taking these private rights taken away. And that also has to do with the oversight. So what you say about incarceration, yeah, oversight is almost, I think, one of the main important things that should be done. What I also want to talk about when it comes to addiction, yesterday I saw a documentary about the fentanyl crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What shocked me that they spoke about that there have been three crises. First, it started, I believe, with Xanax. I believe it was Xanax. Well, what you also see, there's also no oversight in medication. When I was in Florida, I really want to, if you don't mind, I want to tell you this. When I was in Florida, I stayed in a motel, and there was a television in the dining hall, and I saw these commercials about very heavy medication for psychiatric or severe physical problems. I saw these commercials, and I thought, in the Netherlands, we never have these commercials because you discuss that with the doctor in his office. You cannot simply buy them. And I believe, and what you see is then that there is also in that, there is a whole corporal world behind that, who easily prescribe that to people. People get addicted, and these corporations make a lot of money. So you see the same pattern as what you see when you think about the prison system as a million-dollar industry. So there is not enough oversight when it comes to medication, and there is no oversight when it comes to the prison system, and it's needed. Yeah. Now they can do whatever they want to do and get away with it.
Exactly, and I think that's why when you talk about the issues that are not being addressed in the penal system, and that's one of them, not only with the penal system, but also with doctors, with physicians out in the communities. You know, they're putting people on so much medication that these people become addicted, and then they go out and they do some kind of crime, which ends up in prison. So drugs is a serious problem.
Exactly. You make such a good connection because in my whole story, I forgot where I thought about, and that's exactly what you mentioned, because when I watched that documentary, it was not about incarceration or incarcerated people, but I thought, you see, a big part of addiction stems from this way of, you know, prescribing medication so easily. And what you now just mentioned it, people get addicted and then end up in prison, in the pipeline. I call the prison a pipeline. So you see a logic pattern, a ways that it's like, in front of me, I see all kinds of like highways going to the system, delivering these quote unquote bodies to make money from. And people have to become aware of that. This is really happening. This is really happening. I mean, this is worse than in most third world countries. This is really, and what I think is, what people need to think about is, what kind of prison system would fit in the United States if the United States would become more human also to the people in the streets, and when politicians, also federal politicians in the White House, would make that choice to support their own citizens instead of all these stupid wars on the other side of the ocean. Yeah, I think because, you know, adopting exactly the same prison system as that we have here in the Netherlands or in Norway, that's impossible, because our system in the Netherlands is also not exactly the same as in Norway. Every country has its own past, its own culture, its own history, norms and values. But what does a humane prison system mean when it would be implemented in the United States? That would be a very interesting political question. It's not an easy question. Well, it's not a question easy to be answered, but the discussion, it's needed that the discussion starts about this question. How would a humane prison system look like in the United States? I think that's an important one.
Yes. You know, I think they need to do drug testing on the overseers in the prison, even in the police force, law enforcement. They need to do regular evaluations for drugs and alcohol, and also for anger management. But we have a caller, but before taking this call, I'd like to read something that just came to me, and this is from an editor of a social media site, and he said, "Hi, Leona. My name is Felicia Ho, and I'm an editor on, and I won't say the name of the team. We often get in touch with members who can add informed perspective on news and trends. Ken Oliver spent 23 years behind bars, almost 9 years of that time in solitary confinement after being caught joyriding as a passenger in a stolen car. This seemingly hopeless situation didn't keep Oliver from dreaming about the future. In prison, he studied civil rights and constitutional law, and he read over 1,000 books Just a few years after his 2019 release, Oliver was hired as a vice president for Checker.org, a tech company that advocates for fair chance hiring. Nothing would have changed if I had let society define me, Oliver told this group, this team, in a video series. We'd like to hear from you. How have you stayed resilient during difficult times? How can others bounce back from their own setbacks? And these are some of the situations. 9 years in solitary confinement, it really didn't make sense. But I wanted to get that out. And we are going to take a call right now. Do you want to state your name, please? 508.
Hi, Leona. It's Donna Winant. And I have a cold, so I'm just listening today.
Oh, thank you, Donna. I'm glad you came on because some of the topics, and I don't know if you heard from the beginning about Mariam's mom, but she was also talking about other issues as well. So, Donna, can you do me a favor and let the audience know a little bit about yourself and then jump in on what Mariam was just saying?
Could you tell me what happened with her mom?
Yes, my mom. Well, she's 95 years old. She has a mild form of dementia. And a couple of weeks ago, she fell. And now she has become, her condition has become very bad. And she might pass away these coming days or weeks. So we visit her all the time now. She's in a little hospital very close to us. I can walk to that hospital. And well, what I told Leona in the show is that when I look at my mom, she's very confused because of her dementia and being in a complete strange environment to her. She cannot place everything. She cannot see the logic of the environment. And what we see, me, my brother, and my children, is that my mom needs the familiar face of her own family. And what we discussed here in the radio show is that it made me also think about elderly, incarcerated individuals who might become disorientated and they don't have access to family. My mom has a luxury position because, you know, we can visit her all the time. But these individuals in prison, they are in a very unsafe environment, you know, suffering from forms of dementia or other physical conditions, and they are alone. And that's what I felt when I was with my mom.
Yeah, I started out, Mariam, with advocating for people to get a continuum of care with serious mental illness who are incarcerated. But as I went along through the years, I could see the whole picture of incarceration. And, you know, I mean, that's our niche. And our senator has recommended we stick to that niche because we're one of the, you know, smaller groups or one of the few groups that has that niche. But having said that, and being aware of these conditions, inhumane conditions, and I like what Leona has had to say that, you know, we should house in different units. We should house our elderly in one unit. We should house our young people. They might need a little bit more representation because they have a little bit more energy. You know, again, putting wise correction officers with those younger people. But to mix up the population like they do and to double sell without any thought of, you know, how people will get along or how compatible, it's just inhumane. And I'm very sorry to hear about your mom, and not to give bad news, but I lost a brother, my youngest brother, yesterday. Within 2 days, he had an aneurysm. And, you know, he had to be on life support. It caused him to, you know, be brain dead. So it's been a grueling 2 days, but I have, as you said, Mariam, your mom has the luxury of having that presence. Even if her mind is not connecting, I believe her soul, I believe that comfort, I believe that fills her when you're there, when you walk to the hospital and visit her, and everybody needs it. And so I have three things that I advocate in my grassroots organization named FEMI, Family and Friends, the Individuals with Mental Illness Who Are Incarcerated. And that's proper placement, proper care, and family connection. I am fighting the system for family connection. We met with the Department of Correction. They're against free phone calls. And, you know, we just have to do better. And I'm very proud of what you do in the Netherlands. I'm very proud of that country. They have it right.
Thank you. Thank you. And we keep fighting for the people in the prisons in the United States. Because did you hear also that part of the show that Leon and I talked about, that we have to make people very, very aware of the fact that we have no inmates but incarcerated human beings, that there are people in prison. And I said to Leona, we have to bring that message over and over again. But with everything we say, with everything we want to change, always start first with, we are talking about people, we are not talking about bodies.
Correct. Or numbers.
Exactly. That's very important.
I know, you know, they even at Bridgewater State Hospital, where the people have serious mental illness, they have a number. And, you know, I'm not saying it's quite the same as the Holocaust, but, I mean, if you think about the Holocaust and people having numbers, you know, it's just one other way to shame and blame someone for being broken. And rather than restore and recovery.
Exactly.
Yeah. There are that's what Leon and I discussed. Leon asked me that there are really some similarity between the concentration camps and the prison system.
Wow.
The Americans learned from the concentration camps. Yes.
That is pretty sad.
It's
terrific,
shocking.
Really. More than sad, it's horrific.
Yeah, it's shocking because when I found it out, when I, you know, done my research and wrote my book, I thought, well, Auschwitz, in a way, it's not over. The structure is still there. The concentration camps, yes, they are closed and the war is over, but the structure is still there, and that's shocking beyond words.
That is true. There's been a recent report. I believe Leona may have been the one to send it to me, but the Norfolk Inmate Council has cited, you know, different things within Old Colony Correctional Center and the Norfolk Prison. And, you know, it's these correction officers are seen on video sniffing lines. They've been selling drugs. One died in the parking lot of fentanyl poisoning. You know, so they're not even doing themselves justice with these mindsets. You know, and they're not treating people humane. How can they feel that they're humane?
Yeah.
I almost have to, in some ways, feel sorry for them. You know, they need to learn to do better.
When I have these things sent to me, I send them out to others. But when you go to social media, there are so many things happening in the prison. And I ask people when they get these kind of this kind of information, to please share it. I wanted to say real quickly, Donna, I don't know if you remember reading about those police officers, the three, I think they were in Stoughton, Massachusetts, who had been sexually using this 13-year-old girl from the age of 13 to 23, and they found her body in a hotel room. She had died at the age of 23. And there was an investigation that had been going on, and this happened quite a while back, and there's nothing that has ever been brought out about the results
or
if they charged or anything.
That's a shame. You know, she was so abused by people in authority who know better and to, you know, that's just, I don't understand the disrespect for another human being.
Exactly.
It's very hard to understand.
It is, because we see the other person as a human being, so we could never do that. But when you know, that's what we talked about, Leona, when you objectify, when you turn a human being into an object, then you don't connect to the human part anymore, and then you can do whatever you want to do with that person. That's also one of these ground problems in the prison system. they objectify these the human beings in prison. So yeah, well then they can torture them or do whatever they want to do because to them they are not humans. And that's exactly, that's another similarity as what happened in the concentration camps, because Jewish people in the concentration camps were no longer considered human. So they could do whatever they wanted to do with them. Did it matter? And that's another thing that we that you see back in this mass incarceration system in the United States.
Yeah. And I want to say real quickly, too, tomorrow is Thursday. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, I will be talking with everyone, and I want anyone and everyone to come on and talk about these issues we're going to be picking up on after today. But also, you've heard the audience, I want you all to know, you've listened to Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist, and also Donna Wynette from the Family, Friends, and Individual for the Mentally Ill, talking about the issues. When you stop making these calls from June 1st to June 30th, please incorporate a lot of this information you're hearing into those calls. If you can't get anyone, leave messages, but we need to reach the media, because the media needs to stop going in to the prison and start to give these prisoners a voice. And unless we do this, we're not going to see progress in this country. We're not going to see progress in the penal system. Mariam, we have 3.5 minutes. If you will give the audience your contact information, and you as well, Donna.
Yes, okay. My website is www.deeperjustice.com. There you will find my book and where you can order it and what it is about. You can see more about the documentary that I've been participating in and about who I am. I'm also on all the social media except Twitter. I'm only I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
Okay, and Mariam will be back on next Thursday. She will be back on next Thursday at 1 o'clock p.m. I believe it's Thursday, Mariam. Did we talk about that? No, next Wednesday. Mariam will be on next Wednesday, same time at 1 p.m. And Donna, if you want to give your information as well. And I believe
sure, and I just would like to say how much I've learned from both of you, so thank you. And I am Family and Friends of Individuals with Mental Illness. We advocate for those who, you know, become enmeshed within this criminal justice system. And you can go to ffimi.blog. And you can contact us at ffimi.inquiry@gmail.com.
Okay, and in July, on the month of July, we're going to have Franz Dahl back on with us, former 27-year warden from Amsterdam, and he's going to be doing a four-week series. It will be on Wednesday, every Wednesday for the month of July, and his discussions will be on mediation between perpetrators and victims. He will be talking about medical care and meaningful activities in the prisons. He will be talking about relationships between staff and inmates and traumatized staff and inmates. And he will be talking about behavior, patterns, characteristics in prison. And we will be looking forward to that as well. Mariam will be on with us as much as possible because right now she has a busy with taking or hoping to be able to take care of her mom, to be able to promote her book, to continue to be able to advocate for the incarcerated in the United States and do the volunteer work in the prisons. And she has a lot that she's got on her plate right now, so we will welcome her back anytime. But next Wednesday, she will be back on with us the same time as today. I want to thank everyone for listening in, and I also want to encourage you all, starting tomorrow for the whole month, if you can make even a couple of calls, write letters, email, and we're also looking at writing, calling, and emailing the United Nations about these issues in the United States because there are violations going on. So the United Nations, I've been focusing on getting that out to everyone on social media. Be looking for it. Your governors in every state, legislative members, the ACLU, get them all involved, but primarily the media. Please get the media involved. We need to see something going on in these prisons. These individuals need to have a voice. We never talked about the suicides and the causes. Miriam, if we can pick up on that when you come on again next Wednesday, because there are so many suicides. There are so many reasons behind those suicides that we in the public do not even know about. So if we can get that started, we need to, we can't let these people commit suicide or die in vain. There has to be something that comes of it. And there has to be a reason for these serious suicides in this country. So any last minute statements by either of you, I'd appreciate it, and we will close.
So Miriam, I hope your mother, you know, is comfortable and that, you know, she understands within that you're there loving her and caring for her. And Leona, I hope
you for
a great June event. And Harry McHugh, my fellow advocate, he has the whole list of legislators, and he sends out regularly all kinds of news and educational materials to try to teach them to understand.
And we need to focus as well. Thank you, Donna. We need to focus as well, and I want everyone to hear this. These solitary confinement and restrictive blocks that these incarcerated individuals are being placed in and on needs to stop, because they don't have anything when they're in these blocks, when they're in these situations. They have no TV, no books. They have nothing to occupy their minds. They need to have a voice. They need to have an end to solitary confinement and restricted housing. I want to thank you all again for listening in. Please join us tomorrow at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Next Wednesday, with Miriam Jacobs returning. And Donna, I know that you are going to be coming back on again, and you can let me know what day and time, and we can get that set up as well.
Thank you.
I want to pay my condolences to your brother, Donna, and Miriam. I want you to know that we will be keeping your mom in prayer, as well as your family and as well as Donna Wynette's family. I'm sorry that this is going on. We are living in the days now where things are getting more serious. They're getting more detrimental, that we try to bring some comfort to our friends, our family, and our loved ones. So I thank you so much, everyone, for listening in, and we will be closing this episode now. Thanks again, Miriam and Donna.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.